172, Section 3, The Road to War, 1848 to 1861. As you read, look for the expansion of the United States and the role slavery played in that expansion. The Compromise of 1850. The Georgia Platform. The Kansas-Nebraska Act. The Dred Scott Decision. The election of 1860 and its results. Terms: Manifest Destiny, Free Soil, Popular Sovereignty, Compromise of 1850, Georgia Platform, Kansas-Nebraska Act, Border State. The Mexican-American War had not received the total support of American citizens. Some Northerners saw it as an unjust war, taking the territory of a weaker country. But many other Americans had come to believe, even before the war, that America was destined to expand from the Atlantic to the Pacific Ocean. A writer had called this America's manifest destiny. In 1846, while the Mexican-American War was going on, the United States had signed a treaty with Great Britain, dividing the Northwest Oregon Territory between them at the 49th parallel line. The expansion of slavery was not really an issue in this more northern area. The settlement of parts of the territory acquired in the Mexican-American War, however, raised the question of slavery. While some of the areas would not support the crops that required slavery, southern whites hoped that slavery would expand into the Southwest, including Southern California. In the late 1840s, other ideas about how to deal with slavery emerged as it became the major issue in the country. By the 1850s, event after event created more and more tension and conflict between the North and South, most revolving around the issue of slavery. Even the question of states' rights and the rights of the national government involved the right to decide whether slavery would continue to exist in the states that had it or whether it could be abolished by the national government. By the late 1840s, the anti-slavery movement in the North had become stronger. Even Northerners who believed that slavery could not be interfered with where it already existed also believed that the national government had the right to keep it from spreading into new territories. This idea was known as free soil. In the election of 1848, the Anti-Slavery Liberty Party supporters joined with Free Soil supporters to form the Free Soil Party. The Democratic Party responded by adopting a position called popular sovereignty, an idea that allows the people in a new territory to decide an issue, such as whether to allow slavery. From the election of 1848 until the Civil War broke out, slavery and the question of its expansion continued to be a major political issue. It was the big argument over California, over the territories of Kansas and Nebraska, over the Dred Scott decision of the U.S. Supreme Court in 1857, and in the election of 1860. This section explores these events as they led the North and South toward a major split. California and the Compromise of 1850. The new territory of the American Southwest included the desert lands of what later became Nevada, Arizona, and New Mexico, as well as the Rocky Mountains. Many believed that those lands would not attract many settlers. Other new land was more inviting. California especially had many assets. There were good bays for ports and fertile valleys for farming and raising livestock. Mexican citizens had been settling there for many years. Some adventurous Americans from the East also began to settle in Northern California in the valley of the Sacramento River during the rush toward Oregon in the 1840s. After 1848, they were all part of the United States. In that very year, as workmen built a mill for Swiss immigrant John Sutter in California, they discovered shiny flakes of gold. Sutter tried to keep the discovery a secret, but word got out quickly. At first, Americans already in California were the main ones to head for the hills in search of their fortunes. But by 1849, Americans from the East were coming in ships around the tip of South America or making the journey by wagon across the American West. These were the 49ers. California's population exploded as they settled in mining camps and small towns. California needed government. When Zachary Taylor, a military hero of the Mexican-American War, became president in 1849, he advised California to apply for statehood. California voters had ratified a state constitution by November 1849 and requested statehood as a free state. Southern slave owners immediately opposed that, even though Californians had used popular sovereignty, deciding for themselves that they did not want slavery. California's admission as a free state would change the balance of power between free and slave states in the Senate. Debates over the issue, which lasted for 8 months, were heated. Some Southerners predicted that, if a balance of power was not guaranteed, a war between the North and South would come. The two major national political parties at the time, the Democrats and the Whigs, found themselves being torn apart on sectional lines. Leaders trying to hold their parties and the country together tried to find another compromise. In the end, 5 laws passed Congress in a deal known as the Compromise of 1850. Supporters in the North and South saw this compromise as saving the country from breaking up. They hoped it would settle things as the Missouri Compromise had done. Page 375, the Georgia Platform. Southern leaders responded to the sectional crisis by holding conventions to decide how to defend the South and the institution of slavery. A Southern Unity Convention was held in Nashville in 1850. The June meeting took a moderate wait-and-see attitude. In September, the Compromise of 1850 passed. Southern radicals met a second time in Nashville, but there were fewer states represented and fewer representatives there. They condemned the compromise and insisted the Southern states had the right to secede. The governor of South Carolina was sure the South would secede from the Union to keep slavery. Georgia played a key role in keeping this more extreme position of secession from happening in the 1850 crisis. While there were Georgians who believed in secession, more Georgians were pro-Union. The crisis over the Compromise of 1850 led to the formation of new state political parties in Georgia. Those who supported secession and opposed compromise became the Southern Rights Party. Those who supported compromise and opposed secession formed a faction that was pro-Union. This latter group was led by Alexander Stevens, Howell Cobb, and Robert Toombs. After the Compromise of 1850, Georgia held an election for a convention to meet on the compromise. The pro-Union faction won a major victory and formed the Constitutional Union Party at the convention in December. The convention then passed the Georgia Platform, introduced by Charles Jones Jenkins. The Georgia Platform accepted the Compromise of 1850, but agreed to resist if the North did not live up to its obligations or if it hindered slavery. Other Southern states accepted this idea. South Carolina found itself alone in wanting to secede, just as it had during the nullification crisis. Thanks to other states following the Georgia Platform, the compromise was accepted, even though many in the North and South did not like it. In the North, the sight of runaway slaves, including some who had been in the North for a long time, being captured and taken away in shackles, led many Northerners to resist the Fugitive Slave Law. Some began to help slaves escape from those who captured them. In reaction to the compromise, Harriet Beecher Stowe wrote Uncle Tom's Cabin, a novel that depicts the horrors of slavery through the story of the slaves Uncle Tom, Eliza, and Eliza's young child. When the book was published in 1852, it sold 300,000 copies and stirred many Northerners to become anti-slavery. Meanwhile, leaders in the South resented these attacks on slavery and became even more suspicious of the North. The Kansas-Nebraska Act. Back in 1820, Southerners had supported the Missouri Compromise, which allowed slavery in the Louisiana Purchase Territory south of Missouri's southern border. Since that time, Iowa had come into the Union as the only free state from the Louisiana Purchase Territory. Even though the area north of the Missouri Compromise line was mainly plains, some Northerners wanted it open for settlement. Illinois Senator Stephen Douglas wanted to run a transcontinental railroad through the area with its eastern end in Chicago. In 1854, Douglas introduced legislation to organize this area into two new territories, Kansas and Nebraska. To get Southern support, he included a clause stating that the Compromise of 1850 had made popular sovereignty available to the territories. This changed the prohibition of slavery set out in the Missouri Compromise. Since Kansas was next door to Missouri, it might possibly become a slave state, although Douglas personally believed that the land was not good for plantations and Kansas would probably become a free state. When the Kansas-Nebraska Act passed, many northern free soilers believed that the national government had come under the control of some sort of slave power. Georgia's Alexander Stevens had been the manager of the bill in the House, and he was very happy about its passage. But every Northern Whig congressman had voted against it, as had every Northern Whig in the Senate. The Kansas-Nebraska Act killed the Whig Party in the country. Northern Whigs did not want to be in the same party with Southern Whigs. In the elections in the fall of 1854, old Northern Whigs ran under various names. In the end, they and Free Soilers joined to form a new party, the Republican Party. The new party believed that the national government had the right to limit slavery to the areas where it already existed and to ban it in new territories. It also supported old Whig ideas of the national bank and protective tariff. One Northerner who joined the Republican Party was Abraham Lincoln of Illinois. The Kansas-Nebraska Act also strained the ties between Southern Democrats and some Northern Democrats, but the Democratic Party managed to hold together for a few more years. Kansas was the ground on which the increasing differences between the North and South became violent. Those who lived there were to decide if it would become a slave state or a free state. Thousands of settlers moved into Kansas so they could vote. Anti-slavery supporters in New England raised money to send anti-slavery voters to Kansas. Pro-slavery Missourians, some of whom never actually lived in Kansas, crossed into Kansas to vote yes on slavery. The result was a territorial legislature that had more pro-slavery members. It voted to allow slavery. Anti-slavery voters complained about the voting fraud. By January 1856, two governments were set up in Kansas, one pro-slavery and one anti-slavery. Each claimed to be the true government. By the summer of 1856, the dispute had gone beyond the legislature into the countryside. Pro-slavery supporters attacked the free soil town of Lawrence, burning down buildings and looting. After hearing about Lawrence, white abolitionist John Brown and his followers vowed revenge. They murdered five unarmed pro-slavery Kansans. Pro-slavery Kansans retaliated, and Kansas soon became Bleeding Kansas. The Republicans in 1856 ran on the free soil platform of not allowing slavery to expand into new territory, while the Democrats supported popular sovereignty. For its first national election, the Republicans made a good showing. Some Southerners had threatened secession if Republican nominee John C. Fremont won, but Democrat James Buchanan won the presidency. One Georgia planter said that the Democrats' victory would postpone the great conflict for 4 more years. He implied that when a Republican won the presidency, war would begin. The Dred Scott case. 2 days after James Buchanan was sworn in, the U.S. Supreme Court tried to end the arguments over slavery through a decision in the case of Dred Scott and his family. Although he had been a slave his entire life, Dred Scott had traveled and lived with his owner, an army doctor, in Illinois, a free state, and Wisconsin, a free territory. His daughter had been born in Wisconsin. In 1846, Scott had begun the court suit for his and his family's freedom because they had lived in territory that did not allow slavery. 10 years later, in 1857, the case reached the Supreme Court, which was in control of Southerners and headed by Chief Justice Roger Taney from the slave state of Maryland. Taney wrote the decision of the majority of justices. The court ruled that blacks, free or slave, were not citizens, which meant they did not have the civil right to sue. But the court went on to argue that slaves were property. Being in free territory did not change that. In other words, slaves could be taken to free territories by their owners. Finally, the court ruled that Congress had never had the right to forbid slavery in territories. It was a victory for the Southern position, but angry Northerners were not ready to give up. One Northerner who had not given up was John Brown of Bleeding, Kansas. Brown had the idea that Southern slaves needed help to liberate themselves. He came up with the idea of raiding the U.S. government's arsenal, arms storehouse, at Harper's Ferry, Virginia, to take guns and ammunition, arming the slaves, and starting a slave revolt. It was a wild scheme with no chance of success. 8 of his men, including 2 sons, were killed, and Brown himself captured. Brown was quickly convicted of trying to start a rebellion, as well as murder and treason. Brown's mental state has since been the topic of debate, but he went to his death believing in the justice of his cause. Although many Northerners opposed Brown's violence, some anti-slavery Northerners saw him as a martyr. In the South, however, Brown's raid alarmed white Southerners, whose greatest fear was a slave revolt. They were also surprised by Northerners' sadness over Brown's execution. They came to believe that Northerners supported the use of force against them, and that they would have to protect themselves. Some, like Robert Toombs of Georgia, warned that the South could not allow the national government to come under the control of Republicans. The election of 1860. The Whig Party had already died over the issue of slavery, replaced by the Republican Party, a Northern party. In 1860, the Democratic Party also fell apart. Its first convention to choose a presidential candidate was deadlocked. At a second convention, most of the Southern delegates walked out, had a convention of their own, and nominated John Breckinridge of Kentucky as the candidate of the Southern Democratic Party. The Northern Democratic Party chose Stephen Douglas of Illinois as its candidate, with Georgian Herschel V. Johnson as his vice presidential candidate. Douglas had been reelected as senator only 2 years earlier over his Republican challenger, Abraham Lincoln. Some concerned citizens in the border states, those states between the slave states and free states, formed a political party called the Constitutional Union Party and nominated John Bell of Tennessee for president. Meanwhile, the Republicans nominated Abraham Lincoln of Illinois. So there were 4 political parties with presidential candidates in the 1860 election. The Southern Democrats called for the extension of slavery into the territories. They supported a federal slave code and stressed the right of the states. The Republicans opposed that and supported the free soil position. The Republicans also stressed old Whig ideas such as a national banking, protective tariffs, and a transcontinental railroad. The Northern Democrats supported popular sovereignty. The Constitutional Union Party hoped to find some kind of compromise and preserve the Union. Breckinridge said that he and his followers also supported the Union as long as it did not interfere with the institution of slavery. He did not campaign in the North, and the Republicans did not campaign in the South. Douglas of the Northern Democrats campaigned throughout the country, even though he did not believe he could win. John Bell and the Constitutional Union Party got the endorsement of several of Georgia's major newspapers in cities like Savannah, Augusta, Macon, Columbus, Athens, and the state capital of Milledgeville. Stephen Douglas and his Georgia running mate, Herschel Johnson, also got some support, but they were far outnumbered by Breckinridge supporters. Breckinridge won the popular vote in Georgia and Georgia's electoral votes. Abraham Lincoln was not even on the ballot in Georgia and nine other Deep South states. Nationally, Lincoln got about 40% of the popular vote, but Lincoln got 180 electoral votes, more than enough to win the election. The results of the election were a shock to Southern whites, who realized that they had become a minority without enough political power to carry an election. With Republican Abraham Lincoln on his way to the White House, many Georgia leaders thought that their way of life was threatened, as was the right of states to decide issues such as slavery. One Georgia newspaper said, "African slavery is doomed to a war of extermination. The only hope for its preservation, therefore, is out of the Union." Judge Henry L. Benning of Columbus said to the Georgia legislature that the election of Lincoln would lead to the abolition of slavery as soon as the party which elected him shall acquire the power to do the deed. He told his fellow Georgians that to save themselves from the horrors that would occur with abolition, we must go out of the Union, however much we may deplore it. Secession. South Carolina led the way, holding a special convention in December 1860. The delegates voted to leave the United States. The secessionists in other states tried to move quickly as well, hoping that those who wanted to stay in the Union would not have time to get well organized. Opinion in the South was divided, especially in Georgia. Yeoman farmers, as well as many city people, favored trying to work out some type of compromise with the North. Georgians also elected delegates to a special convention held in January 1861, but in Georgia it included many that favored moderation over secession. Breckinridge supporters favored secession, while Bell and Douglas supporters hoped for delay and compromise. Georgia's governor, Joseph E. Brown, an honorary delegate, favored secession, as did Howell Cobb, his brother Thomas R. R. Cobb, and Robert Toombs. Among other things, they argued that if they seceded, they would have more power in talks with the North, which might agree to some of the South's demands. Leading the moderates were Alexander Stevens, his brother Linton, Benjamin Hill, and defeated vice presidential candidate Herschel Johnson. They argued that there should be a Southern convention to discuss what to do. The vote on a motion for secession was 166 to 130 in favor. While the secessionists had won, it was certainly not the enthusiastic 100% vote that secession had gotten in South Carolina. When delegates voted on the formal ordinance of secession the next day, however, the vote was 208 to 89 in favor. Some of the moderates had been persuaded to change their votes to show unity. Most of those hoped that Georgia's time out of the United States would be brief. All delegates signed the final written document, but many were sad about it. At 2 p.m. on January 19, 1861, Secession Convention President George Crawford declared that Georgia was officially no longer in the United States. Georgia was one of seven states to secede at that time. 2 months later, Alexander Stevens delivered what became known as his cornerstone speech. In it, while he mentioned tariffs and other federal government programs, he left little doubt about what he saw as the major source of conflict. "The new Constitution has put at rest forever all the agitating questions relating to our peculiar institution, African slavery. This was the immediate cause of the late rupture and present revolution. Reviewing the section. 1. Define manifest destiny, popular sovereignty, compromise of 1850. 2. Who were the four candidates for president in the election of 1860? 3. Why was the Georgia platform so important? Page 381, Georgia Portraits. Alexander Stephens, The Early Years. One of the most important politicians in Georgia before, during, and after the Civil War was Alexander Hamilton Stephens of Tolliver County. His home, Liberty Hall, near Crawfordville, is today a state park, and Stephens County bears his name. Born in 1812, Stephens lost his mother when he was just a baby. His father remarried and had several more children, including his brother Linton, who became a well-respected judge. When Alexander was 14, his father and stepmother died. The family was split up among relatives. Young Alexander lived with an uncle until entering the State University in 1828. He would later help his brother Linton and other young people get an education. Stephens was a small and sickly man throughout his life, but he did not let his physical ailments and disabilities keep him from achievement. In 1861, Harper's Weekly magazine said of him, "Mr. Stephens is a remarkable example of what energy can do for a man. He has all his life been a martyr to disease and has never weighed more than 96 pounds. Because of his size, he got the nickname Little Alec. He graduated from the university at the top of his class and taught school in Madison County and later Liberty County to repay his loans. He then studied law, being admitted to practice in 1834. For 2 years, he practiced law in Crawfordville before launching his career in politics. He was 34 years old when he was elected to the state legislature in 1836. After being in the state legislature for several years, he ran for and was elected to the U.S. House of Representatives. He served from 1843 until 1859 when he decided to leave office. Stephens was a Georgian who belonged to the Whig Party, the party that believed in a strong national government. He opposed state nullification of national laws and the war with Mexico, which he believed was dishonorable. He defended the institution of slavery, although he believed that slaves should be treated well. He supported the Compromise of 1850 and, throughout the 1850s, opposed secession. Even at Georgia's secession convention in 1861, he continued to oppose secession. However, when his state seceded, he accepted the decision and went with the Confederacy. He still had a long career ahead of him. Page 382, Chapter Review. Chapter Summary, Section 1, Slavery in Georgia. Slaves in Georgia lived under a set of laws called the Slave Code. The daily life of slaves was one of hard work and depended in part on where their plantations were. Slaves in rice plantations worked under the task system, which left them some time for themselves. Slaves on cotton plantations worked under a gang system, where work was based on time. Although a slave marriage was not legal, family and religion were very important in the lives slaves built for themselves. Slaves resisted slavery, ran away, and sometimes attempted revolts. No revolts were successful, however. Section 2, Georgia, the Nation, and Sectionalism, 1820 to 1848. In the early 1800s, the Deep South remained rural and depended increasingly on the growing of cotton. The North grew increasingly urban and depended more on manufacturing. Sectionalism developed and increased the tensions between the two parts of the country. In 1819, there were an equal number of free states and slave states. The Missouri Compromise maintained that balance by admitting Missouri to the Union as a slave state and Maine as a free state. Congress passed protective tariffs to support the growth of American manufacturing. The South initially favored the tariffs, but came to view them as mainly a help to the North. When Congress passed another tariff in 1832, it resulted in the nullification crisis when South Carolina threatened to secede over the tariff. States' rights is the belief that all powers not specifically given to Congress or forbidden to the states in the U.S. Constitution belong to the states. The Mexican-American War resulted in part from the annexation of Texas as a slave state in 1845. Section 3, The Road to War, 1848 to 1861. The issue of slavery and whether it could spread into new territories became the major issue of the country during this period. The Compromise of 1850 allowed California to come into the Union as a free state. Other parts of the legislation created a stronger fugitive slave law, outlawed slavery in the District of Columbia, and allowed the people living in New Mexico and Utah to decide whether to allow slavery. The compromise saved the Union for a time. The Georgia Platform, adopted in a state convention in 1850, supported the Compromise of 1850, but identified certain actions that would not be tolerated, including any action that hindered slavery. The Georgia Platform delayed secession by the southern states. The Kansas-Nebraska Act undid the Missouri Compromise by allowing popular sovereignty north of the Missouri Compromise line. In the Dred Scott decision, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that blacks did not have citizenship and the rights that went with it, and that slaves were property. In the election of 1860, Republican Abraham Lincoln was elected president. At a special convention held in January 1861, Georgia delegates voted to secede from the Union. Page 383 contains a chapter review for Chapter 15.